But today we're here to talk about cancer prevention, and the title of the session is What Does the Future Hold for Cancer Prevention, Early Detection, and Treatment? And our interviewer today is Jonathan Altler from Newsweek, and we're delighted to have him here. Just a reminder to silence your cell phones, and if you can, remember to turn off the wireless feature on your BlackBerry for feedback. Thanks so much.
That's everybody here. I'm going to lead by example and turn off my cell phone. Thank you all for coming to this this session. The only reason, for clarity's sake, the only reason I'm here, my main job is I write a column in Newsweek and get out on television about politics. Is there, what does this guy have to do with cancer? And the answer is that 4 years ago I was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and I had a bone marrow transplant and have been cancer-free since and interested in cancer since. And we are so fortunate to have Dr. John Suffren as our speaker today. For 16 years, he's been the CEO of the American Cancer Society. He's a PhD and was chairman of the Department of Applied Health Science at Indiana University before becoming head of ACS. And he was a huge volunteer in his younger years for the American Cancer Society and sort of came into it in that way. And in the time he's been there, he's transformed the American Cancer Society into what has long been, it's long been the world's largest voluntary cancer fighting organization, but it is now in a new and much, much improved place where it is on the cutting edge of fighting for access to care, which is such a problem for people in this country and worldwide. Over time, they've funded 42 Nobel laureates through the American Cancer Society. I guess I don't want to diss any of your predecessors, but before Dr. Suffren's arrival, it was in a little bit of the doldrums and a little bit searching for what its mission was, because there had been the development of so many disease-specific cancer-fighting organizations. And he has found a role and brought it back, refocused the organization tremendously well, revitalized it, and it is now a major player globally in research, education, and advocacy here in the United States for universal coverage. He first became interested in cancer when his grandmother died when he was 10 years old, lost his mother to cancer. And his wife, Carol, of 42 years, is here with us today. And like me, she is a four-year survivor of breast cancer. So I think that we all have cancer in our family in some way or another, among close friends. It touches every family. It kills 560,000 people a year. And I guess my first question for you would be, the war on cancer was declared in 1971. We're now 37 years out. If you look at the progress on heart disease, which is still the leading killer in the United States, but not nearly to the extent that it was, they've made much more progress than those fighting cancer have, all told. Why?
Well, there's several reasons why you could argue that we haven't made as much progress. I would demur a little bit by saying, if you look at true curative medicine, we've made more progress. But it is true, heart death rates have gone down much faster than cancer death rates. There's several reasons for that. One is, it's an enormously more complex disease. As you know, it's well over 100 different diseases. But beyond that, it has capacities such as to metastasize and go to distant parts of the body, making it a much more difficult disease to figure out. In addition, we have underfunded the war on cancer. We've given a lot of rhetoric, and we've invested some money to be sure but we've really underfunded it. And then I think, thirdly, I would have to say, and I've said this privately, and I've said it publicly, and I'll say it here, we probably haven't gotten the return on our investment that we should have gotten because of a lack of real coordination. Much that was envisioned in the 1971 National Cancer Act, it created a president's cancer panel that reported directly to the White House and was required by law to do so annually. The opportunity there to coordinate the war on cancer was lost in the sense that we really haven't coordinated it over that 37-year period of time as well as we should. But let me be very clear. We have seen 15. The American Cancer Society publishes these statistics for the nation every year. We've seen 15 years, year over year, of decline in age standardized cancer mortality rates. And there are literally 500,000 people walking around our country today who wouldn't be here if the cancer rates had remained the same as they were in 1991.
Now, you mentioned funding. The National Cancer Institute gets about $4.5 billion a year, which is precisely 2 weeks in Iraq. Precisely. Why, for a disease that kills, as I mentioned, more than 500,000 people a year, touches every family, one in every two Americans get in their lifetime, why haven't we made more of a national commitment?
I believe it's because we haven't had the capacity, although I think we have much greater capacity today than just a few short years ago, to educate policymakers and gatekeepers. Now, I'm not talking to the American public now. The American public, we have polled every year for many, many years, and of all diseases they're concerned about, cancer is number one, and has been for 20 straight years, every year but one year in the 1980s, where AIDS was ranked number one concern. So the American people have said clearly that when you are concerned about what disease are you concerned about for yourself and your family, cancer's numero uno. I believe we now have enough evidence to show and demonstrate, bucket full of evidence, that if we do the right things, we can talk about eliminating this as a major public health problem early in this new century. So that's different from when the National Cancer Act was passed. That was passed at a time when we believed in the scientific method, that if we invested heavily in research, we would get answers, which we didn't have. Now we have answers that aren't being applied, and that's why the American Cancer Society is so interested in the issue of access to care. Bottom line is that lack of access to quality health care in America is a major cancer killer. And the number's big, and it's getting bigger. So we know if we can just make sure everyone gets access to what's already available, we can drive those death rates down even more. At the same time, or concomitant to getting better answers as we move forward.
Give folks some examples of the access gap. I mean, I was struck by one in some research that comes out of ACS that Vietnamese American women suffer like four times the rate of cervical cancer as Chinese Americans or Japanese Americans. And some people might go, was that a genetic thing? Why? What is the answer to that and to a lot of the other access issues?
Well, in certainly for Japanese or Chinese or Vietnamese women living in America, bottom line, anybody who dies of cervical cancer in America today has fallen to the safety net, because here's a disease that's preventable, detectable early, and so it's only late-stage disease that causes the numbers are huge. We founded with the American College of Surgeons something called the National Cancer Database. Very controversial when we did it. People said, no, we've already got SEER data, which is another big cancer. But we didn't have databases on stage of disease, outcomes, and whether you had insurance coverage or not. And so we're mining this. Over 1,000 hospitals participate. The bottom line is, if you're a woman with stage one breast cancer, which is 90%+ curable, without insurance, you do more poorly than a woman with stage two breast cancer with insurance.
A lot more poorly. That was what it sort of blew my mind with the gaps.
Yeah. So between 40% and 50% more likely to die. And so we know it's not just early detection, which is a big piece of it. In other words, we also know that people without insurance are much, much more likely to present with late stage disease, more advanced disease. That makes sense because they don't have regular routine access. But even if they have access enough or they're detected early, they're still more likely to die. So how they're treated by the system because of their lack of insurance is disparate.
And there are a tremendous number of people who get cancer and then they're, even if they're insured, their insurance doesn't really cover all of it. I've noticed that in my own case. So something like 1 in 5 Americans, is this right, who get cancer, find that on top of having sort of the roof cave in on them, they suddenly have very, very serious financial problem.
It's unbelievable, and it's worse than we thought, and we thought we knew that it was a big problem, but we have a 24-hour-a-day call center where you can call us and never get a busy signal, always talk to a real person. We kept getting these calls. I've got insurance, and I've got breast cancer, but I can't get the coverage I need. And so we're recording these, and we're going to share them with Congress. But in one case, which we actually did a TV spot that some of you may have seen, this beautiful young woman, Elena Reyna, got cancer when she was 15. She got it again as a young mother of a 4-year-old. She had insurance, and her husband had insurance, but together it didn't cover what she needed for her cancer
therapy. How can the, you know, to a layman, you know, how can the insurance companies get away with that? It's one thing for them to kind of, you know, not want to insure liposuction. Somebody gets cancer. How can we live in a society where they're not?
And that's the and that's a question we raised and led to our doing something that no one else has ever done in from our sector, which was, well, let's just let the American people know about this, because we think if they can see the broken healthcare system through the cancer lens, they're going to say, enough already. That doesn't make any sense. And sure enough, based on the research we've done since we did our paid media campaign last fall, people are just saying, that's not right. That's fundamentally wrong in a society like ours. If someone who's got a major cancer, and everybody at least knows it, whether they're a cancer expert or not, that what distinguishes cancer from many other diseases is that, on the one hand, it's highly preventable, it's highly treated and caught early, excuse me for being so animated, but if you don't get after it, it'll kill you. And so people say, if that person needs this or needs that, they ought to be able to get it.
What are some of the fixes? I think people in this room are very sort of solutions oriented. There's been talk of doubling NCI funding. Hillary Clinton came out for that, then Barack Obama did as well. We haven't heard from John McCain on that score. How important are additional resources? And how important, on the point that we just talked about, is legislation on catastrophic coverage? Is there a legislative fix for this that could just essentially require that if you have life-threatening illness, you get proper coverage?
I'm absolutely convinced that the ultimate solving of the cancer problem is as much an issue of public policy as it is a medical and scientific challenge. It's a strong statement, but I'll stand behind it. The ultimate conquest of cancer is as much an issue of public policy change as it is continuing to invest in medical science and biomedical research. And let me tell you why I feel so strongly about that. We set, the American Cancer Society set, early in my tenure in this job, what we called 2015 goals. And I won't bore you with all the details, but it was to reduce cancer mortality by 50% by the year 2015, which would be huge. Remember, there's 1.4 million new cases each year. We had evidence that we could get 80% there, and we bet on the come with further research, we could get 100% of it. Every year, twice a year, I report to our board of how we're doing, and I show them the curves, and I told you already, it's gone down 15 years in a row, which is proof that we can and have made progress. But I told them we're not going to get all the way there. So they said, well, Mr. CEO, come back and tell us what we have to do to get there. We did a lot of research, have a lot of smart people to work for us, people to help us. And the bottom line is, there are three things that we need to do. We've got to redouble our research portfolio. And the key to this is that we can guarantee results. Not every experiment works, but there's no question now with the human genome being mapped that if we make that investment, we'll get a return on that investment, big time. All right. The second thing, we have to promote prevention into public policy. When I sat on the National Cancer Policy Board of the Institute of Medicine, we published a 350-page book with all the evidence that 60% of all human cancer is preventable during a normal human life. 60% of all human cancer is preventable during a normal human lifespan. So we have to do that. And on the research piece, we have to balance the portfolio. And then the third thing we have to do is we have to provide access to the answers. When the American public, through their taxes, pays for all this research and we get answers, we feel they ought to have access to that. So if we can, those are three big things. I admit that. In fact, the research is...
On the last part, just to focus on that for a second. You're saying that the proprietary intellectual property business is a little out of whack now, and when you're talking about general access to not have it be proprietary for drug companies and universities that are doing research.
Yes, it's a very complicated issue, as you know, but we have to come together and say there's got to be a way to get this done. The country's done it before on other major projects that were important to the nation's health and safety, and they're not. I don't mean to imply they're easy, but they're overcomable. And we have really bright people in the cancer community, extraordinary scientists, but we salute them. But we haven't had people showing leadership to say, okay, now look, let's get together and figure out how we go all the way from ideation and discovery into delivery and improvement of the public's health. I like to make this point that I don't think it was by accident that it was called the National Institutes of Health. It could have been called the National Institutes of Biomedical Research. The concept was that we're going to do research to improve the health of Americans, and we're not doing that because there are barriers and roadblocks.
Translational medicine, they call it. Now, here's the statistic that scares me the most. Of every 10 applications to the National Cancer Institute by qualified researchers, these are people who are in the field, only 1.7 are funded. So the ones that are not funded might be where the cures are, because the way, you know, cancer is political like anything else. So that 1.7, they often represent the older, better established researchers who have good ties in Washington. They have, you know, they work the old boy network pretty well. They make sure their funding stream is still going. And the younger, less established, maybe more creative researchers from whom the real cures are more likely to come, they're getting discouraged, and many of them are leaving the field. So how do we address that?
Well, I think two things we have to do. First, we have to actually supply more money. But then we have a two-pronged plan. Here's more money contingent upon you showing more creative ways to dole out that money for that kind of thing. The American Cancer Society made a very controversial decision. It was hotly debated that we would begin to target beginning investigators because we were worried we were going to run out of them because of the problem you just noted. So we have to be more creative about the ways we fund good science. It's not a question of whether we know how to fund good science. I can guarantee you this, that neither the American Cancer Society nor the Susan G. Komen for the Cure nor the National Cancer Institute fund shoddy science. The problem is the amount of good science that's left on the table wanting those resources. And if we have a bias, it's a bias, some call it the R01 bias. We have a bias toward not being open-minded to things beyond investigator-initiated peer-reviewed research. And that process has served us extremely well for new discoveries, but not so well in terms of looking at other ways to come and solve the cancer problem.
What do you mean specifically by that? What sorts of treatments would not come out of the investigated research?
Well, it's not that they wouldn't come out of that eventually, but much of that work is at the very molecular level. Bench research, it's extremely important to continue that. But we've accumulated huge amounts of knowledge that we didn't have just a few years ago, but that hasn't been translated in every case to develop new compounds that only get to the market and make a difference in the life of a cancer patient. So it's saying that preserve investigator-initiated research, but be open-minded to targeted research and other kinds of ways to come at the problem that might move us more quickly than we otherwise would get there.
Is that, just so that we understand this, is the tilt toward biology, basic biology, as opposed to translational curative research, is that because the latter is kind of like oil drilling? You know, you're trying different things, and if it fails, you're worried you're not going to get funded, whereas if you're doing basic research, you can publish papers that kind of inch the molecular science forward a little bit, and then people go, oh, well, he had an iteration that, you know, was a new insight, and so their funding stream stays open, whereas the wildcatter, you know, who's actually trying to cure these diseases, and he's drilling dry holes, he gets cut off. So the whole system gets kind of biased in favor of the basic science. Is that?
I think that's a fair characterization. I'll give you an example. Donnell Thomas got a grant from us early in his career. He had this cockamamie idea about bone marrow transplantation. And we went back, and I was with him at a State Department black tie dinner, and I went back and we dug out the anecdotal notes of the research, and they said, he's barking up the wrong tree, which is a bit of a pun because he was doing research on dogs. He's barking up the wrong tree, but he's a scientist of integrity, and he deserves a chance. And Phil Sharp was with me at a speaking engagement in Cincinnati, Ohio, and he said, I'll do anything I can for you, because he said, Nobel laureate, Phil Sharp, he said to me, if I were applying for an R01 grant for the first time today, I wouldn't get funded.
A lot of them say that. A lot of the people who develop breakthroughs say that.
Which is frightening.
Is there a way to create a new model that maybe isn't still based in academic and drug company research? Consortium models, there's a lot of talk about that nowadays. Dream teams to try to break down some of these barriers. One of the problems, I think you'll agree, is that some oncologists, even though they're doing God's work, you know, they're doing the most, arguably the most important work in society, they get kind of territorial and forget what they were taught in kindergarten, play well with others, you know, other institutions. So how do you break some of that down and get people working more as a team on looking for these cures?
I think there are a couple things you can do, but let me just put a fine point on what you're just saying, because I think it's extremely important. A lot of good work is being done, but people don't start from the idea, well, let's work with our competitive university down the road in another state. And so, and I sat in a lecture one time where the speaker said, remember, collaboration is an unnatural human act. I don't know if it is, but it doesn't happen unless you put some energy into it. And so we're doing that much more today. And I can give you several examples, but one of which is former President George Herbert Walker Bush and Dianne Feinstein and others started 10 years ago something called Sea Change. It was first called the National Dialogue on Cancer, but its very purpose was to bring major players from all three sectors, the private sector, the public sector, and the not-for-profit sector, all of whom had a major mission to solve the cancer problem, to talk to each other. And immediately we found out, well, I thought you were doing this. No, I thought you were doing that. And someone else said, well, I'm doing that too. We're overdoing that. So I think some coordination has to take place. Then I think there needs to be incentives. I think we need to bring real and new money into the cancer, solve the cancer problem issue, and incentivize people to work better together.
Let's look at the glass half full a little bit. Which cancers are shrinking, the death rate shrinking fastest? Where is the good news?
Well, I think the good news, let me just give a couple of examples because it's extremely important. When our organization got started at the beginning of the last century, any serious diagnosis of cancer was a virtual death sentence, only to be preceded by a protracted period of pain and suffering. That's a heavy statement to make, but it's a true statement. And now, virtually everybody survives their diagnosis and treatment. Most survive long term, and many survive for a normal human lifespan. So we have an opportunity, you know, to get results that we dreamt and prayed for before, but we now have every reason to believe that we'll get that if we do the right things. And I'm sorry, I digressed a little bit from your question.
No, but like breast cancer, if it's caught stage one, is like 95%
exactly. Survival. And Nancy Brinker, Ambassador Brinker, is here, and she can talk about that. And we don't yet know how to prevent it. Hopefully, we will before too long. But here, too, we've had more than a decade of decline in breast cancer mortality rates. The Canadians said mammography doesn't work. That's because they didn't also pass laws after mammography was determined a good way to detect breast cancer and the best until we find something better. We passed legislation to make sure that if you got a mammogram in California or Indiana or New York, they were all high quality. And so clearly, early detection of breast cancer has reduced breast cancer mortality rates. I once started to say early on, remember, cervical cancer was a leading cause of cancer death in women in the 1930s. And it's virtually 100% preventable and curable. A few women die every year because of lack of access. We haven't made any progress, significant progress, in the treatment of lung cancer, colon cancer. 60% of all colon cancer can be prevented or caught very early and with long-term survival.
Prostate
cancer, if the current trend continues on prostate cancer, it will be eliminated as a cause of cancer death in men in probably the next 15 years.
At what point should we say that most cancers are a chronic disease? There are no cures. I mean, I think there are two cures. Gleevec for a kind of leukemia and the vaccine for cervical cancer. But other than that, there are basically no cures. But at what point can we say we can manage this disease as a chronic condition?
But I think it's both. Let me just add to what you said. There are few drugs that are curative most of the time. But when we discovered in 1991 that the cancer death rates were going down, Philip Cole, who's a cancer epidemiologist trained at Harvard, called me on the phone and he said, I was wrong. All my life I've said we haven't made any progress except in prevention. But clearly the downturn in cancer mortality was a combination of prevention and improved therapy leading to long-term survival and indeed cures. So there are surgical cures. And there are people with combination chemotherapy. No one of those drugs may be curative. Together, people are living at least long enough that for all intents. But we will
live long enough to die of something else.
Yeah.
That's the goal. Right?
Yeah, right. That's right. Because they say die young, late in life as possible, or something like that. But it is quickly becoming a manageable chronic disease. Well, we've got almost 11 million cancer survivors in America. Our organization were none. So it's the hopeful side of cancer has never been more hopeful. Secondly, and this is an important point that's often missed on people, cancer is potentially the most preventable and the most curable of the major life-threatening diseases facing Americans. I'm going to repeat that. It is potentially the most preventable and the most curable of the major life-threatening diseases. So we don't know how to cure heart disease. We know how to treat it often better than we know how to treat cancer. Getting those results. But you don't cure the underlying coronary atherosclerosis, as an example. There are a lot of people walking around that once had cancer that could have killed them, that will never kill them. I call that a cure. But we have to do the right things. So we have a moral imperative, in my opinion, on the war on cancer, because we now have the data and evidence that we didn't have in 1971, that if we do these right things, we're going to get big-time results, and that's what people want.
But there's no, you know, use a familiar analogy from the Kennedy assassination in the world. There's no like single bullet theory of cancer. We used to think that you could actually cure the whole disease, and we no longer believe that, right?
I think that the consensus opinion of the scientific community would be that that's biologically naive. That it's multiple diseases, there's certain common anomalies with it, we obviously know, but it's very, very complex. I think what we'll see is many cures on the way to when we virtually prevent it. I believe, and it's perhaps a bias of my training, that we'll ultimately prevent virtually all cancers. That we'll be able to determine who is at risk for what cancers and when and how to intervene and stop that from happening. That's just one avenue of research, but it's a very, very fruitful one, and one that I think, if you look at the history of public health and medicine in the world, you're hard-pressed to come up with very many major diseases like cancer that were ever brought under control by any means other than prevention.
On the treatment side, how do you get more cancer patients to enroll in a clinical trial? That's less than 10%, fewer than 10%, right?
Yes, it's more like 3 or 4%.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm sorry to say that I'm not an expert on clinical trials, but we, in the organization I mentioned, SeaChange, which we help sponsor, they have a whole team on clinical trials, and these are all experts. They actually think the infrastructure in America right now couldn't tolerate more than 10% of people, couldn't take more than 10%, but it's about 3 to 4% in adults, much higher in children, thankfully, and we've made more progress with children. It's a complex issue, but for one thing, many patients are simply never told, you may be eligible for a clinical trial, let's check that out. Secondly, many clinical trials, because of the complexity of the disease, and they're trying so hard to find improvements, have such restrictions as to who can get on it. If you have a comorbidity, which many people do, you may not be eligible for the trial. So it's not an easy fix, but I'm pleased to say several years ago we did, but now we've got a team of experts working on how we can improve participation in clinical trials where I don't know the number, but perhaps a huge 50, 70% of people with heart disease may have the option at least to get on a clinical trial.
Isn't that, going back to the collaboration question, isn't that something that if the doctors talk to each other more than twice a year at conventions, they would get them enrolling, to get their patients enrolling more in each other's trials, and the fact that they often won't share cell lines, research with each other for intellectual property reasons, that until they get cancer in their immediate family, it's even for them, it can be a little bit of an abstraction.
No, it is. And they do talk to each other, I think. Sometimes we do more talking than we do doing. And it's taking that next step of action that is critically and, I think, life-savingly important. It's interesting. The Gleevec story is interesting because each sector, the public sector, NIH, the private sector, the not-for-profits, and the private for commercial sector, if each of those hadn't stepped up, probably Gleevec wouldn't be here today. But because they did decide to collaborate, we've now got a drug that's truly curative for at least a subset of patients with chronic myelogenous leukemia. And I think proof that even though other cancers may be more complex than CML, proof of concept that if we do collaborate, we can come up with better cures.
Isn't that also an example of they weren't actually targeting CML? They were doing other kinds of research, and it was like those old science stories you see where it was almost by accident that they found out it.
Well, that's actually true. That the compound, it had sat on the shelf, and it Peter Drucker hadn't talked to certain people at a certain conference, and they decided, well, maybe we'll look at it again because it's been research project. That's actually a true story, that it was sort of an accident.
Let's just talk about prevention a little bit. You know, we all know about smoking, but obesity has recently been tied much more to cancer than it has been in the past. I think I'm not alone in this room in wondering at what level of being overweight does one's cancer risk skyrocket? You know?
We don't. One of our researchers published in the New England Journal of Medicine 2 or 3 years ago, one of the more talked about on the media, studies about the relationship between obesity and cancer, but there's no denying that there is a relationship. Where that triggering point is, we don't know. However, we do know that there are a lot of things you can do, even if your BMI, your body mass index is higher than it should be. If you can watch what you eat and exercise, you can change your risk of getting cancer. So the key point here is that when we published the official report about 6 or 7 years ago, we had the evidence that at least 60% of all cancer is preventable during a normal human lifespan. And remember, please, that's 60% of 1.4 million cases. That's a hell of a lot of disease that can be prevented. Bob Weinberg, who's an American Cancer Research Professor at MIT, just published in Newsweek a week or two ago that he believes it's now 70%. I believe, hopefully before my career is over, it'll be 80 or 90% can be prevented. So the key point is, and I just... it was just announced that for the first time since we've been keeping records, less than 20% of the American public smoke. It's now 19.7. But to get below 20, when at the time of the Surgeon General's report, it was a majority of all men in America, that's huge progress. And we've proven, of course, that it works, that you can quit and reduce your risk of cancer. So there's a lot people can do. We've actually partnered with the American Heart Association and the American Diabetes Association. And we compete every day in communities for volunteers and money and attention, but we said, look, there are certain messages we can get out there, and basically they're don't smoke, or if you do, quit, and we're willing to help you. You see your doctor as appropriate for age, appropriate screening test, you know, get some exercise, and eat right. You know, how many people can honestly say they can't do any of those things? Not very many. You don't have to win a marathon, but get moving. I mean, we're following 1.2 million people through their whole life. It's the biggest prospective epidemiologic trial in the history of public health. In that study, and it's, we've got subjects in Colorado and subjects in Atlanta, in that study, a male who doesn't smoke and gets some exercise, has self-reported, has an 8% absolute chance of dying in midlife from anything. 8 chances in 100 of dying between ages 35 and 69. Not just of cancer, just dying. His couch potato smoking counterpart, 39% chance.
Wow.
39%.
Amazing.
So it'd be hard to exaggerate the importance of prevention and health promotion.
Let's talk about vitamins, because I think a lot of people in this room are curious about that. And I know that you're very cautious about endorsing anything. There's been some interesting research on vitamin D in particular. I know these things kind of go in waves, they can be faddish, but I think we might be approaching a point where 1,000 units of vitamin D is something that is prudent since it doesn't hurt you.
You know, that, of course, that gets into the whole issue of FDA, and that is, of course, efficacy and safety. And there, as you know, are things such as hypervitaminosis, so you can very recommend something, but somebody can have more. I'll say this. I'll be surprised. The way I would answer this, which is waffling, I suppose, a little bit, is that we have never, no, there's no evidence that there's anything better than a good sound diet. And if you have a good sound diet, and if you look at your teeth, you've got all kinds of teeth in there, not just teeth to chew, but teeth to cut through. If you have a good balanced diet, then you're very likely to get the nutrients, micronutrients that you really need. If, though, a vitamin like D, or another example is aspirin, which is not a vitamin, obviously, but in our study, the study I just referenced, we know that men and women who take as little as one baby aspirin every other day, both men and women, 40% lower colon cancer mortality rate.
Now, I don't think the American public really knows that.
No, I think we've not done as good a job as we should of getting that information out. And people tell me, you know, well, I read this one week, but then I read something opposite the next week, and so there's that confusion. And that's another reason we're trying to work together through collaborations like Sea Change to say, can we get a single message? And former President Bush and Barbara Bush have both done PSAs now to say, here's some things. President Bush says, now you know, now you can't. And some pretty simple messages about how to change your life and reduce your risk of dying prematurely of cancer.
Let's talk globally for a second. If smoking in the United States is down considerably, more than 50%, worldwide, you know, 1.7 billion smokers. What are the consequences of that?
Well, I think it'll have geopolitical consequences. It's something that I'm dedicating part of the rest of my life, not just my career, to. I call it a train wreck not waiting to happen, but we have to understand that in 2025, if current trends continue and we don't intervene, there will be 1 million lung cancer deaths per annum in the People's Republic of China. Another 1 million premature deaths per year from emphysema and cardiovascular disease directly caused by tobacco consumption. That's an epidemic of disease in a single country the likes of which the world has never seen. Influenza, you name it. And many of those deaths will come to only children of still living parents. And so, this conference was so popular. Well, so the bottom line of this is that the good news is, many of you may know, but most of you probably don't know, that we now have, for the first time in history, the first public health treaty in the world. It's been passed by the World Health Organization, called the Framework Convention on Tobacco Control. And it has published protocols of what any country can do in order to stave off this otherwise emerging epidemic. Tobacco in the 20th century killed 100 million people in the whole world. 100 million. Published data. It will kill 1 billion in this century if we don't intervene. And we know what needs to happen to intervene to keep it from happening.
And our economy is so tied to the Chinese economy now that it's in our economic interest.
That would be my belief. Because no matter what the cash flow looks like or how economically developed China becomes, I mean, having 167,000 lung cancer deaths per annum in our own country brought our healthcare system to its knees.
Well, talk about the productivity gains or the productivity losses that we have from 500,000 cancer deaths and what we could add to our GDP getting a little better control over it.
Two things there. You know, we talk about cancer costing our country $100 billion a year, and you can do different analyses on it. But the key point is it's the leading cause of disease death in every age group from 5 to 75, the number one cause of death of people in the prime of their life, when they're most productive, most important to their families and their communities. And some of that, you can put a price tag on it. It's hard, but what does it mean when someone is a single-parent family, you know, when dad dies at 52 of lung cancer? The other piece of this, though, and these are published economics data, and I'm not an economist, and so I asked an independent economist to evaluate what two distinguished professors of economics at the University of Chicago have published, which is that a 20% reduction in age standardized cancer mortality rates, 20% reduction, which is in the bank, will be there in the next 3 to 4 years. We're already past 15%. Nets the American people a $10 trillion value. $10 trillion. So there can be no, in my opinion, no economic argument. I know there are competing concerns, and you know. know, and you can't do everything at once, as I was reminded before the session started. But boy, there's an awful lot of evidence to say, well, I just want to make a big difference. I want to make something happen. Well, I'm a lot more confident that we know what we need to do to solve the cancer problem than I am on what we need to do to solve the Homeland Security problem.
You think of that, it puts the 2 weeks in Iraq figure in a little better context. I think with that, I'd love to open it up for any questions that you have. I think we've got about, five minutes or so?
Yeah.
What? 10? 10 minutes for questions. Yes. Yeah, the importance of inflammation in the disease process. My belief is, and I've been briefed by some of the top scientists in this area, that I personally believe that it's a very important factor. It's a very important factor in heart disease, and a better understanding it's not just a clogged artery, but it's an inflammatory explosive event that occurs, as an example. And I believe personally, that it is a common denominator in virtually all disease processes. However, I would add quickly that we don't know yet, relative to the specific test you mentioned when you have a physical exam and see where that is, how predictive or how important that result is. Not trivial by any means, but I don't think we have all the information we need on predictability about that index.
First of all, thank you so much for what you do. You've talked a lot about prevention, and I'm just curious what you think about this new wave of technologies around predictive genetic testing models. So genome-wide scans that test for correlations to cancer, for example.
You know, I think, assuming we continue to pay attention to those things, I think the technology, Lee Hartwell, the Hutch, believes that we'll be able to use that kind of technology and others, and to basically predict who's at risk, or more specifically, you will over time develop this or that problem, and then be able to intervene. So I think those are extremely important things, and I'm not that techie savvy myself, but the bottom line, I think those things are extremely important, and that's one of the beautiful outcomes of this very precise and highly sophisticated research. Our knowledge of carcinogenesis is huge compared to what most drugs. The question now is to translate what that means and to find ways to say, since we know this, then we can do this and intervene in this way to interrupt these series of events that at the end of the day become an advanced malignancy.
It's unbelievably, you didn't use the word complex, it's unbelievably complicated. Because when you get to a particular type of cancer, there are often 30 or 40 subsets of that, so it just multiplies. And when you drill down into those subsets, there's subsets of subsets.
Well, I remember what Remy DeBoe said in his book 20 years ago or 25 years ago in Man, Medicine, and Environment, more important than what disease a person has is what person has a disease. So each human being is unique. And so it is complicated. And that's one of the reasons that I think it's a valid response to why haven't you made more progress. But it shouldn't be an excuse. It's true. But it's also truthful that we could be further down the pike than we are today if we better coordinated and put emphases in certain places where we know we could get the greatest benefit.
Yeah. Are you in the blue?
Yeah. We have a program in our own organization. Let me make a quick point that I want to just, because I can point this. Our first cancer prevention study, not the one I referred to, but our first one, was done in the 50s, those data went into the original Surgeon General report in 1964 that said smoking is causally related to lung cancer in men. If our organization had called time out then and said, okay, we've got in that 55% of all men smoke, let's find out why people get addicted, how they can stop, how to prevent them from doing it, and really plowed money into that, I would guess we would have solved the problem years ago. Now, your question, there's not enough money. So in our own organization, we have something called pay it thing, We say these are outstanding grant applications. We ran out of money. We shopped those around and had some success in people saying, well, hey, that person comes from Oregon and I live in Oregon, I'll underwrite it. And the point Jonathan made earlier is extremely important. In statistics, there's a law called homoscedasticity. And what that says is if you could bet your bottom dollar if you have a person who's got an IQ of 100 and this one's got an IQ of 105, they're different people in terms of intelligence. But if you have an IQ of 130 and someone else has an IQ of 131, you can't say one's different from the other. We have outstanding grant applications that go unfunded. So the answer, the next big breakthrough, is as likely to be a next experiment as this one. So we're not talking about A and B. We're talking about A and A, but you draw the line. I mean, obviously, one got a little higher score than the other, but you get my point.
Isn't part of what happened historically that when Nixon declared the war on cancer, it was this viral theory of cancer that turned out to be kind of sinkhole in money. It sounded good, but it really didn't turn out to be that promising.
Well, that's right, and it's also an example of being careful if you have a virus that does cause a cancer in an animal, to assume that it will also cause a cancer in a human being. That's true, but remember, the key point is for us to be open-minded about creating new ideas and coming at it from a different angle. So it doesn't mean we shouldn't ever do any more viral research, but it means that we shouldn't say that's the name of the game, and it's only going to be, we're only going to fund research on apoptosis. Natural cell death and why cancer cells don't have the mechanism to cause them to die. That's an important breakthrough. That's not the only breakthrough. There are other ways to come at this, and with enough resources, we should fund them.
The breakthroughs do follow the money. I mean, if you look at AIDS,
when our money was funded
AIDS, they got the breakthroughs. If you look at treatments, in certain areas that have been heavily funded, they've come much faster. So there is a causal relationship there.
There's certainly an association, and I don't disagree with that at all. But I just want to make sure that, we can do better, but the investments and the fact that we've got, close to 50 comprehensive cancer centers around the country has gotten us to a place where we wouldn't have been had we not have done those things. And that's making, the bottom line is that I'm proud to say to you today, we can document that we're saving 90 more lives each and every day, closer to 100 lives each and every day than we were when I took this job. And now, what keeps me awake at night, what keeps me and Nancy and other people awake at night, is that we also have evidence that we can redouble that number tomorrow if everybody got access to the quality care we need.
Because cancer is a disease of aging,
exactly.
As the population ages, the breakthroughs have to continue or they'll slip back.
Exactly.
In the early 90s, they did slip back and actually had an increase in cancer death, right?
Well, we actually have had, it's interesting, we've had decreases every year since 1991 in the death rate, which standardizes the rate. But no epidemiologist predicted this. We had two years in which the actual number of people who died was fewer than the year before. And no one saw that coming because it's counterintuitive because as age increases, your risk of dying of cancer increases, and of course it's an aging population. That may never happen again until the day we eradicate the disease.
You've had your hand up for a while.
TGen in Phoenix, Arizona, just received a huge grant from from Luxembourg. Millions and millions of dollars are coming into that. Now, if that's a small place in the universe because cancer is so global, are there other places in the world where they would be an invested partner with us?
I think that's very possible. There's no question, but what more, the question had to do with a foreign investment in stuff going on here, and we're looking into that right now in terms of philanthropy for the world, what we call the worldwide fight against cancer. But I think the opportunity for creative investments in solving the cancer problem are out there. Our pharmaceutical industry pumps billions and billions of dollars of proprietary information, but I suspect it's 7 to 8 billion per year. But the bottom line is that based on what we know today, it's still not enough. And if solving a problem becomes important enough to the American people, we have plenty of money to do it.
$7 billion into new cancer research, or is it not about drugs?
Well,
it does.
It's an issue. But there's a tremendous amount of research going on there, and that's a controversial point. And in truth, we probably do need knockoff drugs, but we also need the development of really new innovative drugs. There's enough money to say we spend $2.2 trillion per year on healthcare in America, which is twice as much per capita as any other country in the world. This year we'll spend over $7,000 per person. We are not getting the return on that investment that we should. There's no reason for us. We're 23rd for men and 17th for women in life expectancy in the world, and that's unacceptable.
We've got time for two more. We're getting both in the back, which is a little underrepresented. Some people back there have their hands up earlier and saved it. Okay. Maybe. All right, from the front. Yeah. Sure. Questions about pesticides and hormones in your diet. How does that affect
It's a very good question for which we do not have a highly precise answer, but there is an answer. First, the answer is that if indeed there are pesticides and other petrochemicals in our environment, they are not a major cause of cancer in this country. However, that doesn't mean they don't cause some cancers. And so one is wise to be as discreet in one's lifestyle. And clearly, you're hugely more at risk if you go to dinner and sit next to someone who smokes a cigarette. I mean, it's like one is potential.
But and if you eat burnt red meat, right? That's pretty strongly linked now to the first engine.
It is. No question about it.
But people
do have a right to say, hey, wait a minute, what's going on? I'm doing everything right. I'm exercising, I'm eating right, I don't smoke, I'm behaving myself, I go to the doctor, and now I've got some malignancy. And so the Dahl and Fito data, who were two of the most well-known cancer epidemiologists in the world, predicted that maybe 3% of cancers occur for unknown environmental insult reasons. Unknown, when we know that tobacco causes 30% of all cancer deaths per year. But so what is wise and prudent we have to be careful. We're often criticized. Well, why don't you say more about some of these things? Well, the problem is that, to give you a concrete example, in this audience, there's a study out there that indicates California Environmental Protection Agency has said exposure to secondhand smoke causes breast cancer in some women. We've reviewed those data. We believe that they are not convincing. And we're not going to say it unless we are certain it's true, because if we say it, then it's sort of gospel. If we say that you got it, we held the line, the government told us no mammograms till 50, we said baloney. We can show you we can save lives between 40 and 50. We're not going to change. Now they've come to our way of thinking. So we're not going to say that, because I'm not going to let any guilt trip on a father who happened to smoke while his daughter's growing up to get breast cancer when she's 42 and then think I caused her breast cancer when, to me, the evidence isn't there to appear.
You can't say some of this stuff because of the reasons you just described, but I do think that cancer survivors would agree that there's a kind of a balance. If you just, load up on every vitamin and assume more is better, you're going to have bad interactions and probably get sick from it. But if you can do things, as the Greeks said, in moderation, that don't hurt you, but might help you, why not? Why not, drink more green tea? So there are sort of many things that you can do, even if the science isn't totally enough. We have time for one more question. Oh, no, we're getting the joke sign. So thank you all very, very much for having me.